the crude power and resources to make 20th century forced schooling happen as it did came from large corporations and the federal government, from powerful loan-established families, and from the universities, now swollen with recruits from the declining Protestant ministry and from once clerical families. All this is easy enough to trace once you know it's there. But the soul of the thing was far more complex, an amalgam of ancient religious doctrine, utopian philosophy, and European-Asiatic strong state politics mixed together and distilled. The great facade behind which this was happening was a new enlightenment. Scientific scholarship, in league with German research values brought to America in the last half of the 19th century. Modern German tradition always assigned universities the primary task of serving industry and the political state. But that was a radical contradiction of American tradition to serve the individual and the family. Indiana University provides a sharp insight into the kind of science fictional consciousness developing outside the mostly irrelevant debate conducted in the press about schooling, a debate proceeding on early 19th century lines. By 1900, a special discipline existed in Indiana for elite students, bionomics. Invitees were handpicked by college president David Starr Jordan, who created and taught the course. It dealt with the why and how of producing a new evolutionary ruling class. Although that characterization, suggesting as it does kings, dukes, and princes, is somewhat misleading. In the new scientific era dawning, the ruling class were those managers trained in the goals and procedures of new systems. Jordan did so well at bionomics, he was soon invited into the major leagues of university existence, an invitation extended personally by rail tycoon Leland Stanford, to become first president of Stanford University, a school inspired by Andrew Carnegie's famous Gospel of Wealth essay. Jordan remained president of Stanford for 30 years. Bionomics acquired its direct link with forced schooling in a fortuitous fashion. When he left Indiana, Jordan eventually reached back to get his star bionomics protege, Elwood P. Cubberley, to become dean of teacher education at Stanford. In this heady position, young Cubberley made himself a reigning aristocrat of the new institution. He wrote a history of American schooling, which became the standard of the school business for the next 50 years. He assembled a national syndicate which controlled administrative posts from coast to coast. Cubberley was the man to see, the kingmaker in American school life, until its pattern was set in stone. Did the abstract and rather arcane discipline of bionomics have any effect on real life? Well, consider this. The first formal legislation making forced sterilization a legal act on planet Earth was passed, not in Germany or Japan, but in the American state of Indiana, a law which became official in the famous 1927 Supreme Court test case Buck versus Bell. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the majority opinion allowing 17-year-old Carrie Buck to be sterilized against her will to prevent her degenerate offspring, in Holmes' words, from being born. 20 years after the momentous decision, in the trial of German doctors at Nuremberg, Nazi physicians testified that their precedents were American, aimed at combating racial degeneracy. The German name for forced sterilization was the Indiana procedure. To say this bionomical spirit infected public schooling is only to say birds fly. Once you know it's there, the principle jumps out at you from behind every school bush. It suffused public discourse in many areas where it had claimed superior insight. Walter Lippmann, in 1922, demanded, quote, severe restrictions on public debate, in light of the allegedly enormous number of feeble-minded Americans. The old idea of participatory democracy was insane, according to Lippmann. The theme of scientifically controlled breeding interacted in a complex way with the old Prussian ideal of a logical society run by experts loyal to the state. It also echoed the idea of British state religion and political society that God himself had appointed the social classes. What gradually began to emerge from this was a Darwinian, caste-based American version of institutional schooling, remote-controlled at long distance, administered through a growing army of hired hands, layered into intricate pedagogical hierarchies, on the old Roman principle of divide and conquer. Meanwhile, in the larger world, assisted mightily by intense concentration of ownership in the new electronic media, developments moved swiftly also. In 1928, Edward L. Bernays, godfather of the new craft of spin control we call public relations, told the readers of his book Crystallizing Public Opinion that invisible power was now in control of every aspect of American life. Democracy, said Bernays, was only a front for skillful wire pulling. The necessary know-how to pull these crucial wires was available for sale to businessmen and policy people. Public imagination was controlled by shaping the minds of school children. By 1944, a repudiation of Jefferson's idea that mankind had natural rights was resonating in every corner of academic life. Any professor who expected free money from foundations, corporations, or government agencies had to play the scientific management string on his lute. In 1961, the concept of the political state as the sovereign principle surfaced dramatically in John F. Kennedy's famous inaugural address, in which his national audience was lectured, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." 35 years later, Kennedy's lofty Romanized rhetoric and metaphor were replaced by the tough-talking, wise-guy idiom of time, instructing its readers in a 1996 cover story that democracy is in the worst interest of national goals. As Time reporters put it, the modern world is too complex to allow the man or woman in the street to interfere in its management. Close quote. Democracy was deemed a system for losers. To a public desensitized to its rights and possibilities, frozen out of the national debate, to a public whose fate was in the hands of experts, the secret was in the open for those who could read the entrails. The original American ideals had been repudiated by their guardians. School was best seen from this new perspective as the critical terminal on a production line to create a utopia resembling Epcot Center, but with one important bionomical limitation. It wasn't intended for everyone, at least not for very long, this utopia. Out of Johns Hopkins in 1996 came this chilling news, quote, "The American economy has grown massively since the mid-1960s, but workers' real spendable wages are no higher than they were 30 years ago. That from a book called Fat and Mean, about the significance of corporate downsizing. During the boom economy of the 1980s and 1990s, purchasing power rose for 20% of the population and actually declined 13% for the other four-fifths. Indeed, after inflation was factored in, purchasing power of a working couple in 1995 was only 8% greater than for a single working man in 1905. This steep decline in common prosperity over 90 years forced both parents from home and deposited kids in the management systems of daycare, extended schooling, and commercial entertainment. Despite the century-long harangue that schooling was the cure for unevenly spread wealth, exactly the reverse occurred. Wealth was 250% more concentrated at the century's end than at its beginning. I don't mean to be inflammatory, but it's as if government schooling made people dumber, not brighter, made families weaker, not stronger, ruined formal religion with its hard-sell exclusion of God, set the class structure in stone by dividing children into classes and setting them against one another, and has been midwife to an alarming concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a fraction of the national community.